famous guitarist?
Roger Waters.
Roger Waters.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Roger Waters.
I'm not like a huge Pink Floyd fan. Yeah, I know they're good or whatever, but My dad said he saw him in concert. When my dad, you know, he grew up
like in their heyday.
Yeah, yeah. My dad. So we don't live that far, or he didn't grow up that far from Milwaukee. Right. Yeah. It's like an hour and a half drive.
And he had
so
a lot
like,
of big bands come through.
Oh yeah, Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee. You know, it was a huge like destination. Every band that toured in the 70s stopped in Milwaukee. Right,
right, right.
So he saw a bunch of shows, and he told me. His favorite shows he ever saw were Springsteen and Alice Cooper.
Wow. Oh,
and he said Alice Cooper he loved because he was like,
Milwaukee.
But he was like, Alice Cooper earned his money, right? Like, he put on this fucking great show. You're like engaged the whole time. Like, fuck yeah. Be my fucking son. He's getting his own fucking head cut off
like,
or whatever.
Didn't he like perform? Like, it wasn't just music. It was like.
Yeah, he was doing. He did like Kiss kind of stuff, where it's like lots of pyrotechnics, lots of like theater.
Did
act
he see
stuff.
Kiss?
I don't know if my dad ever saw Kiss. I think my dad thought Kiss was like fucking hokey.
Yeah,
like it was like you know just like
but
they're
like
all
Midwest
face paint.
Kiss like fucking.
Oh, the Kiss Army. The Kiss Army is still strong.
Yeah,
right? If you look at keychains, you'll see Kiss Army. Yeah. Around. But no, he said Pink Floyd was one of the worst bands he ever saw.
Really?
And I was like, why? And he's like, I mean, I guess they're good or whatever, but they sat up there the whole time just like, aren't you all so lucky to come and see us play this concert?
Live
like,
is fucking, a different thing. Yeah.
It turns out a fucking auto mechanic from Menasha doesn't like that. He's a big fan, you know? And Springsteen, I saw Springsteen.
I'm sure Springsteen. I heard he's great.
I saw him... Oh, man, it would have been 2010, so like, you know, so many years ago, but it seems recent. But, he, you know, at the time, he was like 52 or something like that. Like, he was like well into his 50s, and he put on a fucking four-hour show.
Yeah.
He crowd surfed.
He's very high
at
energy.
One time.
Yeah,
yeah, like, he's high energy. He clearly loves putting on, like, a great show and, like, doing the work. So
even at that age,
he's still going hard. And all that's the problem with, like, Pink Floyd, the Beatles were like this, too. Where, like, at a certain point in time, you, like, forget that if you don't have fans, you're just a bunch of fucking assholes playing instruments, right? Like, if you don't have people who are actually willing to, like, go see you and buy your music or whatever, you're just, like, bing, 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 ding, ding, ding in your basement. You know what I mean? You're no different than just, like, any nerd with a hobby. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, Emily saw Bon Jovi up in Massachusetts, and she said he was terrible. He was, like, so drunk, and he was, like, lip-syncing, and he wasn't even, like...
In his defense, he was in Massachusetts.
It was like Gillette Stadium or some shit like that.
Too close to Mount
But he
Florida.
Was like shirtless and like still like hot at like 50-something.
I would have preferred a show. I mean, I wanted it. Dead or alive. Oh, I almost got a spit take. I was halfway there.
Right into Dr. Hitchens' college.
That's all my Bon Jovi. That's the only references I can do.
So, shall we begin part two?
I mean, it's your life. It's now or never.
Whoa. Living on a prayer.
I don't
want to
live forever. All right. Four, three.
Welcome to laughing.
It'll never not be funny when you fuck up. It's always. Should we do it again?
Yes.
All right, we won't own that mistake.
You're listening to Laughing Historically with Adam Latz, Adam Cooney, and Dr. History Scholar.
Welcome to Laughing Historically. I'm your host, Adam Lax. On the ones and twos, we got Adam Coonan. And we got Dr. History Sage Scholar, moral supporter of feelings.
Dr. History Therapist Scholar. We've actually been having
some group sessions.
Yeah, we've been having groups. These are our group sessions. So, like, literally every story we've done has been about one of our personality problems. Just like
real
Adam's
coding.
Got some real John Paul Jones vibes. You know what I mean?
Never mind the fact that I think he's the tallest one of the three of us.
That's true. Yeah. Dr. History Scholar. Basically, we're doing Teddy Roosevelt, so you can just get over it finally. Yeah, it's been an obsession
well,
for too long.
I mean, this is going to be an ongoing saga.
Oh, yeah. There's at least two more parts.
There's
maybe three. Possibly four. We'll see.
And then he dies, and it's beyond the grave.
Well, then we'll just move over to Franklin Roosevelt. Yeah, you know.
Right.
Teddy Roosevelt's legacy.
And, we got this day in history.
So today, August 4th in 1792, Percy Shelley, the husband of the much more talented Mary Shelley, is born at Field Place, Warnham,
Sussex. Hot take. Yeah. All right.
I don't know
who Percy Shelley is.
He's a really overrated poet.
He was like a pop poet laureate kind of thing. You know how there's a poet laureate every once in a while in the U.S. and you're like, okay, man. And then like, it's just like they're good for their time, but they're not timeless way like a really good writer.
Well, and the other thing is that he's this like upper class aristocratic guy who's like, oh, my life is so terrible. And you know, I hate everything. I'm like, dude, you are an aristocrat. He's born in 1792. You're an aristocrat at the apogee of being an aristocrat. There will never be a better time to be.
One of those romantics.
Yeah.
You could be an aristocrat right now and have an Xbox, which is better.
but as an actual aristocrat now, you don't really get to do anything.
You can't really like ride around on a horse and just like bang random. I shouldn't say bang.
And get
assault.
Away with killing people.
Yeah,
like,
assault
know, like,
people
or
in
like,
various
or,
ways.
Or, you know, control the fate of nations. Mm. Right? Like, you don't have that. You're just sort of window dressing.
Yeah, now you got to go to California, dress in a robe, worship Moloch. Like, it's all a bunch of, it's a bunch of steps now.
So he was born at...
Why do you keep denying that Moloch is a real thing? It's history now. It's a real thing. And every time I bring up Moloch, you just change the subject. Because you don't want to believe it. But it's true.
It's just... I don't care.
Listeners, rich people burn an effigy of a fucking owl in California. It's like every 4 years or something like that. Yeah. They do it. Nobody knows what they say. They just do it. You know what I mean? That's truth.
Yeah.
It's true.
So he's born at Field Place,
that's
Warnham.
That's Dr. Moral History Scholar approved because he didn't argue.
Born at Field Place, Warnham, Sussex in England. So for lax, England is that island across the water.
Is that in your script?
Yes. And Coonan, Sussex is just to the southwest of the Shire.
Oh, that's good. Which Shire?
The Shire.
Oh, are there multiple Shires?
Yeah, but I'm talking about the one that you know of from Lord of the Rings.
I thought the entire island was the Shire.
Mm. No. So
what are you, a brandy book?
Yeah.
Brandy book? I don't know.
So, part two of Teddy Roosevelt's Crowded Hour.
Fool of a Took.
Mm-hmm. All right, so stop. Is Alone in Cuba. Is the name of this part.
He's alone?
So Theodore Roosevelt wrote over 30 books in his lifetime. One of these books, published in 1899, was The Rough Riders, Roosevelt's account of his wartime experience. So he writes this book immediately.
Are you going to do the song?
No.
What
you really want?
What were you actually gonna say?
No, I just, it's so funny. The like Teddy Roosevelt, like Rough Rider saga, like him going off to this war to prove his manliness or whatever the fuck.
That's what we're gonna talk about.
It's just like a whole, just like.
It's weird that it's like, it's both lame but also true at the same time. Like, he did really, like, I haven't charged up San Juan Hill. Have you charged up San Juan Hill? Not even a little. You know what I mean? So it's not like, at least. As far as like pompous rich dudes, at least he walked the walk. You know what I mean? Like, he actually went out west. He actually fist fought a gunfighter. You know what I mean? Like,
Was he actually under threat? Like running?
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he writes this book about his wartime experiences, The Rough Riders, and he often speaks in the first person, using the word I throughout.
Which makes
him
like
a third person kind of person. Like,
I was just going to say that. Like, that makes him infinitely better than MacArthur.
Yeah.
Like, MacArthur did this and MacArthur did that. Why are you talking like that? You fucking psycho.
He talked in the third person?
Yeah.
MacArthur did.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Caesar did too. Yeah. All the worst fucking assholes.
And Napoleon.
History.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Napoleon talked in the third person.
Did yeah,
you?
Probably. So a humorist,
like, the short man did this. The stop saying.
So a humorist would later say that his favorite work by Teddy was, quote, "Alone in Cuba," end quote, which is what he said that the Rough Riders should have been called, "Alone in Cuba,"
because nobody else was there.
Because he keeps saying, "I did this and I was here for that." So Roosevelt had finally got the war that he had longed for. He joined the army before the declaration of war. So he actually resigns his post and joins the army before the declaration of war.
If I remember correctly, that was like everyone was like, don't do this.
Oh, yeah, no.
Wasn't he like 45?
He's just about 40. He's like just about to be 40. Yeah.
So he's like, that's
his middle age crisis or whatever.
Well, a little bit.
Also, at the time, 40 was 95. Yeah.
No, that's not. No, you could live into your like 70s and 80s. It is that. War, especially because he's going to go into, because Roosevelt has an understanding of his own limitations, for instance. He doesn't go into the Navy, which was the thing that he was always sort of obsessed with, because he's like, I don't understand the mechanics of how to sail a ship. I don't understand engineering and that sort of thing well enough.
You need to know that stuff?
To be a naval officer? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you would absolutely need to know these things.
Underlings need to know that.
No, the officers are the ones who do all of these things. And if you were to command a ship, you would absolutely need to know all of this. Mm. And he's like, I don't have the time to learn it. Like, I can't learn it quickly enough to fight in the war.
Like, have you ever heard of, like, construction manager at a construction site? It's basically the guy at the construction site that kind of knows how to do everyone else's job, but also has to see things from a big picture. Yeah. I get the impression officers, and especially naval officers.
Well, and especially captains.
Yeah,
the captain of the ship has to know a little bit about everything. Like, if you're the engineering officer, you probably don't need to know much about gunnery, right? Until the gunnery officer's dead. But the point being,
usually the guns aren't working. Anymore.
But he's like, you know, he's like, I can't learn that stuff quickly enough. So he goes into the cavalry. The cavalry, pre-Civil War,
getting back to his rancher days.
A little bit, but he's like, I know how to ride a horse, I know how to shoot a gun. And the other thing is like, at West Point, before the Civil War, you were assigned to engineers, artillery, infantry, and cavalry based on where you graduated in the class. Mm-hmm. So the top of the class goes into the engineers, the next group go into the artillery.
Why is the top is engineering?
Because it was an engineering school.
It's hard.
West Point in the 1800s basically only teaches engineering. Hmm. That's the only thing you're taught. You don't learn military tactics and strategy until you're a senior. Everything else is engineering. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So Robert E. Lee was an engineer because he graduates top of his class. Sherman was in the artillery because he graduated sixth and only the first four went into the engineers.
Well, he got his revenge at the end.
Yeah.
He's like, suck it, Lee.
Oh, are you an engineer? Come on, come on, come on.
So, and then,
suck it, Lee.
So, like, the middle went into the infantry. So Grant, for instance, graduates more or less in the middle of his class. He goes in the infantry. And then the people dead last go into the cavalry. Right? So, like, George Armstrong Custer graduates, I think, dead last in his class.
Yeah, he was a dumb piece of shit.
But the thing,
wow.
But the thing is that being a cavalry officer doesn't require a lot of engineering. What it requires is, and you don't even need to know a lot in terms of tactics and like alignment the way that an infantry officer does. Yeah. What you need to know how to do is
ride a horse,
shoot a gun, and keep everyone else who needs to ride a horse and shoot a gun together. That's all you need to do. Okay. And so Roosevelt's like, I'm going to pick what is, from the officer's point of view, the simplest job.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the one that I can learn the fastest.
And right? Also, I'd say, of all of those officers up until the modern
era, machine guns.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, yeah. Until machine guns. That was the one where it's like, you needed the most, like, what is that? Elan.
Yes.
As the French would call it. Like, if you could really be like, follow me into the depths of hell. Like, cavalry is kind of where you wanted that.
Yeah,
infantry was more just people. Like, you fucking stand there and don't you move. Right? Like, you're going to stand there and you're not going to go and turn around. Whereas cavalry is like, we're going that way.
Which way is
the hardcore bros.
Which way is the enemy?
Right.
Okay? And that's the direction we're going. So,
Mm-hmm. Maybe you're going to talk about this, but what is his motivation for doing this?
So the first was to make sure he has two main reasons for joining the army before the war begins.
Okay.
The first is to make sure that he's in on the ground floor, right? To make sure that he is in early enough, that he's gone through training quickly enough, that he will be sent into combat.
So he just really wants to go
in. And the second reason is he wants to avoid the quote-unquote mistake of his father of missing the Civil War, mm-hmm. right? The only thing that he thinks his father did wrong in his entire life was pay for a substitute during the Civil War and not fight.
He wants to go into war, like, for valor?
Yes, for valor, for moral
reasons.
Yes.
Like, that, there is, that kind of stuff?
It is a combination of
it's
that.
It's not careerist.
It's not. I mean, I think there's always a part of him, right? Roosevelt, there's a part of him that goes, if I play this right? There can be things after.
Yeah.
But there is a part of him that says that. There's a part of him that goes, I don't want to be like my dad and miss the war. There's part of him that wants to prove that he can do this. And there's a part of him that also goes, I have been the loudest advocate for a war with Spain. Mm-hmm. I am not going to send someone
you
else's
put his
kids.
Money where the mouth
exactly.
Is.
Yeah. So he's like, I am not going to be this person who says, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith from Ohio, you get to see your boys come home in a box. Mm-hmm. I will be right there with them. Right. That's his,
say what you want about Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. He was not a hypocrite.
No.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and it's like whether you agree with that thing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing too is like, I remember, you know, I'm 100 years old now, but like, I remember when you're younger, there's something about like that, like, test your metal mentality. Yeah. Like, what am I really fucking made of? And I, you know, I've never faced down bullets or anything like that or whatever. But, like, even to, like, a degree in Peace Corps, it's like...
Going abroad.
Can I live in this community? Can I deal with the heat and the lack of running water and the like, is that the kind of thing that I can endure?
Yeah.
Right. And the World War One generation, I think, was the ones who got really fucked by this is the hardest.
Yeah.
Right. Because they had not really seen, like, there had been little hints at industrialized war and how
the Russians and the Japanese fought, for instance, but everyone,
even the Civil War, was
but everyone papered over that because they're like, well, it's the Russians and the Japanese. They're just too stupid to understand how modern war is
too stupid to understand that you have to stand up with red pants above the trench like a true Frenchman.
You just run at them with bayonets.
Le pantalon rouge est français. You know, the red pants are France.
But like, and I think especially
that was
said that?
There was this is the stupidest argument in the history of the world. Before World War One, the commander-in-chief of the French army goes, I would like to introduce a slightly less stupid-looking uniform for the French army. He's like, and I'm going to even compromise. He's like, we're going to go with the horizon blue. So it's this like kind of dull blue color. Yeah. But if you're laying down in mud, it's reasonably good at breaking up your silhouette.
And it's still enough like that. What's the French thing? The fleur,
But it's still, but it's hearkening to that blue uniform of the Republic. And the argument that carries the day in the French Senate is the red pantaloons, the red pants are France. That is the argument that prevents the French Senate from approving a new, slightly more drab-looking uniform. It can be a capsule.
Oh, so they originally had red pants and they wanted to change
it. Yes, and
kept it.
And they kept the red pants until the end of 1914 after everyone... The French suffer 250,000 dead in the month of August. 1914.
Are you serious? Wow.
I am not joking. 70. They took 25% of all of the. Or not dead.
Guys, we gotta make a change. That way we kill like a quarter million people.
They're shooting off our penises. So we have to do something different. Like,
so
really lighting a fire on your butt with that.
I think we actually, as a podcast, finally landed on the historical cutoff of what we can make fun of. And
it's
I think
1914.
It's World War
I. After 1914, it gets sad instead of funny.
Yeah, yeah. After 1914, you're like, those poor boys.
So Roosevelt has no meaningful military experience aside from 3 years in the New York National Guard in like the 1880s. But on April 25th...
Would you argue that his time out west was at least in to some degree an equivalent training?
Oh, I mean, he would credit it that.
Oh,
He's like, it taught me how to ride, and it also taught him how to interact with... this is where he learns to interact with people who aren't from Harvard and Manhattan.
Right.
So on April 25th, 2 days after the start of the war, he's made lieutenant colonel, that is the second in command of the 1st Volunteer Cavalry Regiment. Now, he had been offered the job of full colonel, command of the regiment, but he demurred. He's like, I don't want that. So the 1st Volunteers would be led by Colonel Leonard Wood, a regular army officer and a close friend of Roosevelt. So Roosevelt's like, one of his best friends is made the colonel of the regiment. So all was not well within the Roosevelt household. His youngest son, Quentin, was born on November 19th, 1897, and Edith had fallen had quickly fallen ill in the aftermath of that birth.
Right.
Her condition worsened to the point where Roosevelt took her to Johns Hopkins to undergo a dangerous hip surgery to remove an abscess that had formed. He feared that he might be widowed a second time. In addition to this, his second son, Kermit, was deathly ill, while his eldest son, Ted Jr., was in the middle of a nervous breakdown.
Wait, was that the same Kermit Roosevelt that later worked in Iran?
That's his son.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. Okay.
The breakdown, Ted Jr. is having in the middle of a nervous breakdown. The breakdown was almost certainly caused by TR pushing him too hard. Ted Jr. was 11 in 1898.
Oh my God.
So Ted Jr. has to go live with his Aunt Corrine in Connecticut for a while. And a friend noted that Roosevelt remained calm through this whole period, but also never lost sight of his desire to go to war. So he's constantly like trying to put out the fires that are in his personal life while being like, I'm gonna go to war.
I'm going to go play soldier.
By early summer...
Seems easier. Seems preferable to this. I just, as the one father in the group, I mean, if you're like, hey, man, do you want to... You know, change diapers for the next 6 months or do a tour in Iraq. I would pick change diapers, but it wouldn't be like immediate. It would be like, change diapers for sure. Do they drink in Iraq? Like, can we have fun?
So by early summer.
Drive a tank?
By early summer, he had sold off all of his remaining cattle left over from his ranching days. He'd reorganized his finances and took out a life insurance policy. As Ada Donald put it, quote, he calculated that his family no longer needed his financial support, even if he died. End quote. So he's setting the stage for being like, if I die, they'll be fine with money. So the Rough Riders were an interesting unit.
Stop. Drop.
Rough Riders home.
You're gonna have to get over that. It's gonna come up a few more times.
Never. Never.
So the first volunteer cavalry were an interesting unit. They were authorized to a strength of 1,000 men, but only 565 would go to Cuba, so they don't get to full strength. Roosevelt...
They didn't need those DM extras. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, sir. I can't wait until he puts out another album.
Sorry.
All right. Are we done with DMX references? No. All right. All right.
So Roosevelt himself estimated that about 75% of the regiment were cowboy types, as he called them. Around 95% of them were native born, but there were also Native Americans and Mexicans in the regiment. And remember that in 1898, Native Americans would only be counted as U.S. citizens if they went through the naturalization process.
Really?
Yes, they won't be granted U.S. citizen, like birthright U.S. citizenship until the 1920s. The way the U.S. government viewed it was, you are a
brown,
separate...
Brown, no. Hey, yeah,
yeah. You are
red, worse.
You are a separate nation, right? So you are not a citizen of the United States. Yeah. That was the legal reason.
Yeah,
that's one of those things where it's legally, you're like, I kind of understand that.
Yeah, but it was
practically
born out of
you're being a fucking asshole. Yeah.
And they used it very selectively. Yeah. They're like, we can take over your land, but you know, you're a separate nation, so cool.
Why does your nation keep getting smaller?
Oh, wait,
smaller.
We got Oklahoma now. So while most
that's gonna last for a little while.
Yeah, we got Oklahoma. Luckily, there's a lot there, and we're gonna use it a lot for so many important things.
Corn. So while most
football,
that one musical that one time,
and it gets you good.
So while most of the regiment was from out west, there were 50 Easterners from elite clubs and colleges, including a professional tennis player, a master of hounds, and a top steeplechaser, so a top horse rider who jumped over obstacles for fun.
Oh my God.
The Westerners included...
Dressage?
Yeah, basically, I think, kind of similar to it.
In Cuba?
In this unit.
I wasn't listening.
Yeah, that's fine. The Westerners included a sheriff, a marshal, two Crocketts, and at least one outlaw that the lawman in the regiment had once hunted.
Hey! I know you! Shit!
I'm sorry. That's the one fucking... I'm sorry. He was some sort of criminal? And you're like, yeah, but I mean...
Just bank robbery.
You know what I mean? It's here now. It's fine, you know?
So round
two. Do you remember Sally? Oh, are we Eskimo brothers on Sally? Oh, the West was crazy, baby.
So round
two. Oh, dear, man.
So around two-thirds of the regiment had seen their fathers fight in the Civil War, a fact that both impressed and embarrassed Roosevelt because his father didn't serve in the Civil War. Most of the men were property owners.
This is the Rough Riders. They're like, my daddy fought in Antietam. Hey, Teddy, where'd you do? Man, that sunset's beautiful tonight, guys. He just keeps changing the subject every time they bring it up.
You know, that is interesting. I don't know if he would have changed the subject. It is an interesting question of how he would have talked about it if it had come up. He might have just been like, I pretend to not to hear because
I love my father, but he was kind of a pussy. Wait, so this is TR assembling the Rough Riders?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm describing.
Where did they get the name? Did we already discuss this?
We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that.
All right. Yeah. So was it beforehand or after?
No, their official name are the 1st Volunteer Cavalry. Right, okay. That is their...
And they were like, we need to be cool.
Yes. So most of the men are property owners.
I mean, that's a get-laid nickname. You know what I mean? Like, were you in the 1st Regiment? Rough Riders? Oh, the Rough Riders.
Giving me the vapors.
Would you, sir, be willing to give me a Rough Ride? I'm also a fan of a Rough Ride, sir.
So in the tradition of...
Dr. History Scholar does not approve of that.
It's the moral probity.
Tiny side of him. Yeah.
So, and in the tradition of the volunteer units to this point in American history, they elected their junior officers. So the lieutenants and captains are being elected by the rank and file.
I'm sorry for another aside, but this is one of those things that you will hear right-wing people talk so much shit about, like leftist, like socialist, like whether it's the Spanish Civil War, Soviets, whatever. They'll talk so much shit about they elected their officers like a bunch of idiots. And you're like, we did that for so long, you assholes.
For like 150 years. Yeah, at least.
Yeah. And we did really good in those wars. We, you know. What do you mean?
Well, so sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's not necessarily the most efficient means.
You know, I'll say this. As a comedian, don't elect the funny guy to be your regimental commander or whatever. It's like, oh, he's so fun to drink with. And then in battle comes, you're like, where is he?
Yeah, I want a lieutenant I can drink with. It's
like, that lieutenant, he makes me laugh. Bullets are flying. Where did he go?
I don't see him anywhere.
I hear a weird like sobbing sound somewhere. So the regiment was not only made up of unique individuals, but was also outfitted and equipped in a manner apart from the rest of the expeditionary force. So they wore brown uniforms instead of the blue ones that the regular troops are issued. So they're wearing a uniform that is different than the rest of the army. So you can tell them apart. This is entirely designed. This is Teddy being
it's,
like,
it's rough, baby. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We gotta go brown.
So Roosevelt's version of this.
Downtown brown, baby.
I don't know.
Roosevelt's version of this uniform was custom made for him at Brooks Brothers on Fifth Avenue.
He's a free. They know it by name at Brooks Brothers.
They do. They made him his cowboy outfits when he went out west.
Yeah, I know.
They're like, Kenny, what are you doing this time? And he's like, I'm going down to Cuba.
Fuck it. Every single time he goes through the doors, every salesman gets like a little heart. Like, oh my God, I'm going to be able to buy my wife something.
It's like half of his fortune is spent at Brooks Brothers.
Brooks Brothers outfit? Was he a cosplayer? Was he cosplayer the whole time?
I mean, a little bit.
It's one of the things that I find so interesting about it, and I'm sure Dr. History, you feel the same way, that like he was actually a tough guy. Yeah. Like I would not want to fist fight Teddy Roosevelt.
No, absolutely
he's
not.
He'd probably fuck me
it's
up.
True. Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I might do some jujitsu on him.
He learned jujitsu.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, later in life.
I'd just fuck him with the balls. He would fuck me. You take guard, he'd fuck me up. It's fine. But like, but so he is legit, like, mm-hmm. not...
He's not... He is an amateur who is
overachieving amateur. Oh,
he's an overachieving amateur. He is almost like it's almost like the way an anthropologist goes into something, right? He's just deep diving right into it. He is like there is nothing held back. He is like, if this is what we're going to do, this is what we're going to do, and I want to do it exactly the way the people who normally do this do it. Right?
And straight the funny in. Part is that anthropologist is going to do it 100 times better than anyone mm-hmm. from where they come from.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to know it 1,000 times better, but they're never quite going to be as good as the people they learned it from.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like,
yeah.
they're never going to, because they didn't grow up in the
same exactly. Right? Yeah,
it's so still accepted. Just a moniker that I was born in the darkness.
Yeah, exactly.
You only adopt from the darkness.
He's just cosplaying, like, really hardcore cosplay.
It is, but it's done with a lot of. It's always done with a lot of respect, like both the ranching and then this. Right,
he knew that.
Yeah,
right.
He knew. It's like he. I get the impression that he was like, "Listen, guys, I am not here to like try and be better than anybody. Just teach me what you know, and I will respect the fact that you know."
He had
that
a bit
thing.
Of humility.
You know,
about it.
He did, and he's like, you know, don't let my accent. Don't let my accent think that I can't do, like, if you want me to do something, you need to tell me to go do it, because I will give you 110%. He never claimed to be the best at anything that he did. Especially
give me a task and I will accomplish it at 110%. What's a percent?
I will try very hard.
I do it very much for you, sir.
Hasten quickly over there, right? You know, that was
what's a hasten?
I will go fast.
I'm sorry if I'm using those big words that we use over in the North Atlantic.
So his uniform from Brooks Brothers has 12 additional pairs of glasses sewn into it at various places.
It's like a John Wick's outfit if he couldn't see. Like, you know, in John Wick where he's constantly pulling guns and clips. Just, Roosevelt just putting glasses on his eyes like, oh, I can't. Oh, no.
So the regiment carried Colt revolvers, Bowie knives, and the brand new bolt-action Craig Jorgensen carbines. So these are new rifles.
I've heard about that.
They're
that
terrible.
The oh, they're bad.
Oh, they're so bad. No. They were overly complicated. They're like they're apparently this is one of the issues that comes up with
gun manufacturing all the time.
Well, yeah, and but also like with I was going to say with like people on the internet who talk about military hardware, which is like you think about it in how it would shoot in the shooting range. Like a Craig Jorgensen rifle apparently on a shooting range is really great. Like it's when it's clean and you don't have to do a whole lot.
Yeah, it's the M16 versus the AK-47.
Yeah. Right. Well, and especially the M16 when you don't give it stainless steel receivers.
No, why do you need that? Why do you need that in a jungle?
Yeah, exactly.
Full of rain.
Yeah.
Why would you need that?
So you know, the Craig Jorgensen is the rifle that is used. It's the most modern rifle in the American arsenal. But it's like prone to jam. It
but like
loads
once you get it out into like
into the jungle, the for jungle instance, or, yeah. of Cuba, for instance, it loads kind of stupid. Like the way that it loads is not intuitive.
Does it load from the top?
So it's a bolt action,
right?
Okay. So imagine, you know, if you see a bolt action rifle and you open it, normally bolt action rifle magazines go straight down from opening the bolt, okay. So the bullets are stacked up underneath the bolt. The Craig Jorgensen, they're like pushed in at like an angle that sort of serpentines, almost like it in the way that like a revolver does.
Oh.
And so you're adding a bunch of unnecessary movement that, and it also means
get
that you
easy
can
jam up.
Yeah, right? It's easy to jam up, and it takes, you can't load it the Mauser rifle that the Spanish are going to use can be loaded 5 bullets at a time.
Yeah, and they just push them down on a spring.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas the Craig Jorgensen has to be reloaded one.
Overly complicated.
Yes, it's overly complicated. That's the problem.
Another good example of that too, and a lot of people don't know this, but when the U.S. Air Force switched from propeller planes to jets, the amount of maintenance went down a huge amount. Mm-hmm. And the simple fact of the matter is, jets engines have a lot less moving parts in them. Like, you need all these like weird gears and shit like that to make a propeller spin, whereas a jet, it's just that one kind of like solid unit that spins those blades. And so it's like the actual amount of like maintenance you would have to do on it to keep it moving, the amount of oil you need in the engine, all of that stuff goes down.
So many regular army units were still issued with single shot rifles. There are.
It's not better.
No, I'm just saying, like that. But that's what I mean is that the Rough Riders have, you know, bolt action repeating rifle. There are a lot of regular army units that after every single shot are going to have to reload them.
And still tearing the fucking.
No,
thing
they're self-contained bullets that they load from the breech, but they're not good rifles.
Didn't the Germans still have rifles that were one shot in World War II? The bolt would. Yeah. It wasn't automatic.
And then finally, the regiment received from John Jacob Astor, the one who would die on the Titanic, a battery of 1895 Colt machine guns, thus making them one of the few regiments in the Army to have actual machine
guns.
They
had machine guns back then.
Yeah, as opposed to the older Gatling guns. So most of the Army
handheld.
No, they're like on a, but these are like mounted on a tripod and fed with a belt.
Are they past the Maxim or before?
This is right around the same time as the Maxim. These are not as good.
The Maxim came out as the like.
This is the end all be all.
Nobody wanted anything else than the Maxim at the time because it wouldn't jam and the belts fed through well.
And it's water cooled.
Is it a machine gun?
Yeah, the Maxim machine gun is.
I know nothing about
that. That's fine.
I'm learning a lot.
No, but it's the advantage the Maxim had over, for instance, this Colt machine gun is an air cooled machine gun. And what that means is it uses the air to cool the barrel.
Right.
The Maxim was water cooled, which means it has the shroud over the barrel that it pumps water into.
Okay.
And so the advantage of an air cooled machine gun, much lighter, much lighter. All modern machine guns are air cooled.
Right.
The advantage of a water cooled machine gun is basically as long as you have water, you can keep shooting.
Mm-hmm.
It will not overheat because there's water in the barrel.
And when you're fighting in, say, World War I,
yes.
and you need to keep shooting
Russians.
Always.
Yes.
Like you'd never stop.
Or those Frenchmen in their red pants.
Well, no, and actually, I remember because I just did the editing on this, but in one of our last episodes, we talked about how military commanders always write battles as if they're like the most epic thing that ever happened, no matter what. And I remember making a reference to the South Africans and the British in South Africa and them being like, they come on like a hurricane of spears and it was blah, blah, blah. That there was a rhyme at the time for British soldiers, like whatever they have, it's
whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun and they have not.
Which means it doesn't matter how many fucking troops show up. It doesn't matter what kind of defensive area we're at. Right. All we got to do is set up like 4 of those guns and go, and we win.
Was this against like natives?
Oh yeah.
Who had like.
Yeah.
Spears?
You could make a pretty strong argument that the British would not have been able to like hold down their like eventual imperial empire without the Maxim gun.
Yeah.
Because it literally makes like the way that like in ancient times, one guy on a horse is worth 5 guys on foot.
Okay.
One guy with a Maxim gun is worth like 30 guys with rifles.
So, that's it. 30 really good guys with rifles.
Yeah.
Because with a bolt action rifle, I think John Keegan, who's a British military historian, talked about this. He's like, a really good rifleman, a really well-trained rifleman with a bolt action rifle, after years of training, can maybe get off 25 rounds in a minute, can fire 25 times in a minute, maybe. a total idiot can sit down behind a Maxim gun and fire 600 bullets in a minute, yeah, right? Like you. Yeah. So it's that idea of it's the rate of fire. Interestingly enough, the Spanish have Maxim guns. Anyway, so because of the manner of the
a lot of guns, I have no idea what you're talking
so
about.
So because of the because of the manner of this expedition and how poorly managed it was, only the officers were allowed to bring their horses. Okay. Right, so thus the papers would call them. Well, the newspapers referred to the first volunteer cavalry as Roosevelt's Rough Riders. The men in the ranks often referred to themselves, quote, as Wood's Weary Walkers, end quote. Because
so he charged up the hill on a horse, and they all just like ran.
Yes, but think about that in practically being the only man on a horse when there are machine guns.
I mean, you'll get laid afterwards. Like, if you make it, like, you're going to...
So a quick note about Colonel Leonard Wood, right? He's the commander of the original commander of the Rough Riders. He was born on October 9th, 1860.
So Roosevelt wasn't the commander.
Not originally. Oh, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So he's born in 1860 in Winchester, New Hampshire. So he's just a year younger than Roosevelt, or a year or two younger. His family was descended from Mayflower passengers, so he's very, very old school.
Womp, womp.
And and Roosevelt, or Leonard...
trash.
Yeah.
British trash.
Yeah. Euro trash, no!
So he was raised in Massachusetts. He studied medicine at Harvard and then served as an army doctor in the last campaign against Geronimo. He received the Medal of Honor in that campaign for carrying dispatches 100 miles in 2 days through hostile territory.
Why was it hostile?
Because of Geronimo.
No, I know.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I feel like Adam's being a little sarcastic.
Yeah, fair enough.
Why is that territory hostile? Oh, because it's not ours? Because it's not our territory and other people want it more? Okay, yeah.
He rode the first 70 of those 100 miles and then walked the last 30. So he rode 70 miles in like a day and a half and then walked another 30 in the last day.
Wow, goddamn.
He was later stationed in Georgia, where he enrolled in Georgia Tech for fun and then organized their football team, was the coach, and played left guard.
Okay. What?
And he
what year was that?
In the 1880s, 1890s.
They had football, though.
Yeah, and he led them to... This is
he
how...
He actually started a frat, and nothing bad ever happened again.
And this is to tell you how new football was. He led them to a 2-1-1 season, which included a 28-6 victory over to the University of Georgia. So there were only four games that season.
Only four games, wow.
He later became the personal physician to Presidents Cleveland and McKinley.
The average lineman is just massive. He's 210 pounds.
Yeah, he's 5'11".
If there's one experiment, of all the experiments I would do with a time machine, it's putting up a fucking, like a 1910.
The Packer team that won the first Super Bowl versus, like...
The Packer team that won the last Super Bowl.
Or yeah. No, even better, just... Whoever was last year's college football champion. Yes.
Because the Harvard-Yale rivalry of 1898.
Because the Packers, there were Packer players at the first Super Bowl who smoked cigarettes at halftime.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Probably
yeah.
Had
and
like,
Chiefs, yeah.
Yeah. And cheese, they smoked.
Chiefs.
Oh, sorry.
They played the Chiefs.
Oh, you know that? I did know. But. No, but it's just funny because like the average lineman, like the average offensive lineman today is like 320 pounds.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. It's
ridiculous.
6'8".
Yeah. And the average lineman back then was like 195 pounds.
The like evolution of athletes is insane.
It is.
Like if you like look from like, I don't know, late 19th, early 20th century to like now, like
the Olympics are great. The gymnasts in 1920 are basically just doing the Charleston. Like, not exciting at all.
Yeah. They're not jumping over themselves.
And like Simone Biles is doing like eight like somersaults.
Yeah.
Or the ability to jump over Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah. He's standing fully upright.
Yeah. Yeah.
All you need to do is give her two pistols and she could take out a regiment, basically, like a fucking Matrix character.
Leonard Wood becomes the personal physician to Presidents Cleveland and McKinley, in which role he meets Roosevelt. So that's how they know each other.
Didn't Cleveland die?
No. Grover Cleveland has the two non-consecutive terms.
Oh.
And it's during his second
Garfield
term.
The one.
Yeah, it's Garfield that dies. He would go on to serve as the third chief of staff of the army. So the post of chief of staff of the army isn't created until like 1901. So he'll be the chief of staff of the army eventually. And to date is the only medical doctor to have been made chief of staff of the army. Huh. Right, because he has an MD. So on June 14th, 1898, the Rough Riders and the rest of the 5th Corps left Tampa Bay for Cuba. Roosevelt was confident.
They were desperate to get out of Tampa.
So much so that they left stuff behind.
Like, God damn it, we gotta go to war. Like, it's fucking Tampa Bay, everybody.
We have had enough Four Loko. We can't have any more Four Loko. All right.
We'll all die before we fight the Spanish.
Listen, everybody, get the meth that you got from Tampa and hit it right before we go into Cuba. And we're
this is like
great.
The first day that Tampa Bay actually existed. So from day one, they're like, we gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, no. There's so many flip-flops. So many dudes who have business propositions for me. I can't.
So much crypto, I don't.
So they left for Cuba, and Roosevelt was confident that not only did he have the best regiment in the army, but Kunin, you'll love this, but that his troops could have outfought Caesar's fabled 10th Legion. Oh my God. For the listener, Kunin just rolled his eyes so hard they may have fallen out of his head.
Yeah, you could see me roll my eyes from space. Caesar. Oh, Caesar's translated. Whatever.
So
no, because it was literally the same situation where a like industrial and technologically like superior army just shows up in a place to fuck. Oh, could you do the same thing they did? Yeah. Well done.
It's true. So, yeah, this is a technical. Why is Caesar's 10th Legion a good thing?
They were his like essentially his bodyguard. They're the ones who crossed the Rubicon with him march on Rome.
They were undeniably good soldiers, but it's one of those things where it's like the same thing happens with Alexander and a bunch of other where it's like the Spartans
and the Napoleon's old guard and the Imperial Guard of Napoleon's old guard.
They get the same treatment where everybody acts like they have like fucking, you know, like
magic.
They have force fields around them.
The weapons of the time don't draw blood when used on them. Yeah.
And really the real reason they won was just kind of like a weird like trick of history. Yeah. It was like they had better armor. In Napoleon's example, he just kept replacing them with more citizens of France. Oh, you want to kill more people? I got some more.
So, the short trip to Cuba is described by Roosevelt in a letter to his sister Corrine, one of over 100 he would write during the 133 days he spent in Cuba. He writes letters like, constantly.
Oh my God.
Not just to her, in general. He writes a lot of letters while he's in Cuba. Quote, and you need to bear with me here, but there's a reason why I picked a romantic poet as this day in history.
Okay.
Today we are steaming southward through a sapphire sea, wind-rippled under almost a cloudless sky. The black hulls of the transport setting off the gray hulls of the men of war. Last evening we stood on the bridge and watched the red sun sink and the lights blaze up on the ships for miles ahead and astern, while the band played piece after piece, from the Star-Spangled Banner to The Girl I Left Behind Me. But it is a great historical expedition, and I thrill to feel that I am a part of it, end quote. So he's very romantic about his...
Whatever.
Yeah. He's just waxing poetical.
Yeah.
He fucking loves drama.
He does.
Amazing.
They all liked that shit back in the... Have you ever... You read a letter between a fucking seamstress and a cobbler at the time, and they're like, the great import of his Lord Jesus Christ's providence over our simple life. Like, it's just, they all do that.
Ones that we read about, because this is like one of the places where, like, for instance, Ulysses S. Grant is different. There's a quote from him that is, he's at some sort of gathering and he's supposed to give up and give a speech that he had not prepared for. And he goes, I appreciate those applauses and I have nothing more to say. And then just sits down there and he's just like, really? I'm done. Yeah, he was not, he once joked, I only know two tunes. One is Yankee Doodle and the other isn't. Wow. Like, you know, he doesn't,
not a modern president. No. It's like
not
he could get away besides the corruption. I don't know.
But it wasn't his fault. He
yeah,
was
I know,
a bad judge of character.
And alcoholism.
Dr. History Scholar is going to get mad at you.
He was not. So
he's not an alcoholic.
So he may there is no. So he's forced to leave the army in the 1850s for being drunk on duty. Okay. That's true. That is not a lie. There is no firsthand account of him drinking at all during the Civil War.
Really?
Not one. Really? Every single firsthand account in air quotes attack. Is someone he just replaced as a general writing a letter, an anonymous letter to the Secretary of War or to the General in Chief, being like, Grant was super drunk, and like to the point where the Secretary of War Edwin Stanton sends an assistant secretary out to the West to look, and this guy comes back and is like, I did not see him drink once.
So like
just
people
at
who
all.
Had an axe to grind.
Yes, people who had an axe to grind. Absolutely kept saying it, but there is not a single firsthand account of Grant being of not only not being drunk, of just not drinking. Like he signed temperance pledges.
Interesting.
So like the man had a problem with alcohol, I think, right? Based on what happened to him when he was out west.
Yeah.
But that he went, I can't ever do that again, right? You know.
Yeah, it was enough. It was enough of a rumor to stick, so that anyone who ever had a problem with him could like throw it down.
He just throws it in his face. Yeah.
So this great historian. No, it's all right.
I'm just throwing around
baseless
legends,
baseless lost cause bullshit. Anyway,
I mean, you could say the same thing about Alexander the Great. Wasn't an alcoholic, right?
I have no idea. Alexander the Great.
I'm trying to get you on another tangent. It's fine.
So this great historian
just like fucking.
No, he was a total alcoholic. Alexander the Great was a fucking raging alcoholic. Yeah. It's not even a question. Yeah.
So this great historical expedition consisted of 15,000 men, 800 officers, 400 auxiliaries, 2,300 horses and mules, Gatling guns, mortars, howitzers, light field guns, and heavy siege artillery. All of it under the command of the round-faced, beady-eyed, gouty, 300-pound General William Rufus Shafter.
Okay, I have a few questions about William Rufus Shafter.
Yeah.
What does gouty mean?
He was plagued with gout at the time.
So he had a big fucking, like, lump on his neck?
No. I think it meant that he basically couldn't walk.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always kind of forget what gout is.
It's like, it's not a disease we have to deal with a lot anymore, or an illness we have to deal with a lot anymore, but
You do if you drink a lot.
Yeah.
My understanding is if you drink too much.
And I think it's also like, if your diet isn't balanced enough in terms of, like, if you eat too much meat, right, not enough not meat. The man's only real qualification for command was a Medal of Honor received over 30 years before during the Civil War and having no political ambitions whatsoever. Roosevelt would grow to hate him. General Shafter also has the distinction of leading the kangaroo court-martial of Henry Flipper, the first black graduate of West Point in 1881. So, yeah, he's not a cool dude.
Definitely a neutral person who like took a stand against injustice.
No, absolutely not.
All right,
no.
So the name like Shafter said,
So
some listener was like, "My name's Shafter, and I'm a good person."
So the strategy that was developed was very straightforward, if uninspired. The objective was to take the Spanish colonial capital of Santiago de Cuba from the landward side. So they're going to take it from the land. To that end, they were going to make landings at the villages of Daiquiri, which is 18 miles east.
Daiquiri?
Yes.
Like 18, Banana Daiquiri.
Kind of, I guess. 18 miles. This is 18 miles.
This is a chicken and the egg thing. Like, did the drink come first or the city, right? Like,
no idea. So
that's how they celebrated at the end.
So that Daiquiri is 18 miles east of Santiago. And Siboney, that's the other place they were going to land, which is about 8 miles east of Santiago. So they're going to land two forces east of Santiago, march inland, take the city from the landward
the
side.
The city of Daiquiri.
No, city of Santiago.
Santiago.
So once ashore, they would first link up with Cuban rebels under the command of the tall, stoic, and brilliant mustachioed General Calixto Garcia. So this general, if you ever look him up, he's got...
My name is Calixto Garcia.
His mustache...
And I am here to have a victory.
His mustache goes past his like cheeks. Like
wow. This is what I call the liquid picker-upper.
So
I got French for some reason.
Garcia. He was a veteran of all three of Cuba's wars for independence. He fought in all three of Cuba's war for independence and was skilled in the use of light artillery. He would be snubbed by American leaders and not allowed to enter Santiago with his men after the surrender of Spanish forces. He dies.
Wait, so he was racism? He was like an awesome freedom fighter on the yes. Cuban side? All right, yes. So I take back everything I said about him. Yeah. I thought he was on the Spanish side.
No. He's one of the Cuban
Zorro, basically. Yeah.
He's Zorro. Cuban Zorro.
He died of pneumonia at age 59 on December 11th, 1898, in Washington, D.C. The treaty with Spain that formalized Cuban independence was signed on December 10th, 1898.
Wait, how long did it last? How long does it...
133 days.
133 days.
Yeah. Wow. In Cuba, at least.
So he led the kangaroo court...
No, General Shafter leads the kangaroo court. Garcia is a Cuban independence fighter.
That they hook up with...
Link up with at Daiquiri. So once they merged the beachheads, they would march towards Santiago. So the landings at Daiquiri...
Just passing pina colada.
Mm-hmm. and they would dance in the rain.
And the Spanish Civil War. If they blew up the main... So, and you don't know what for.
If you like dancing it, man...
And getting caught in the rain of artillery.
So the landings at Daiquiri began on June 22nd with naval guns forcing the bare handful of Spanish troops to leave. The rest had already been driven off by General Garcia's guerrillas. Roosevelt and his Rough Riders disembarked unopposed to the tune "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight."
God, that sounds like one of those fucking dumbass.
The Rough Riders.
It's fucking. Is it ragtime?
Yeah, basically.
There'll be a rough time in the town tonight.
Yep. They were the first ashore because Roosevelt had an old Navy friend move them to the front of the line. With the landing unopposed, General Garcia's troops met
the... You really wanted to get shot in the head.
Honorably. With the landings more or less unopposed, General Garcia's troops met the Americans who shouted... The American troops shouted, "Viva Cuba Libre!" And the rebels responded with "Viva los Americanos," possibly the last time such sentiment has ever been uttered by Cubans.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, yeah. No, I love it.
So
what actually happened is they were like, "Viva la Cuba," and they're like, "Okay." Like, what the fuck did you say? As a person who learned his Spanish in the Dominican Republic with a very Midwestern accent, mm-hmm. it's actually very funny. Yeah. Like, you go like, "¿Cómo estás, mi amigo?"
The Stars and Stripes went up over Daiquiri, and the Americans moved inland.
I'm sorry, that just sounds really funny.
You're like, "Quick, before we leave Daiquiri,
couple for the road.
Yeah. Can you get us a couple of limes, some salt, and some tequila, because we gotta
make a couple of roadies." So to link up the beachheads at Daiquiri and Siboney, the Americans would have to hold a pass at a place called Las Guasimas, which is about 8.5 miles east of Santiago. Okay. Right. So the troops at Siboney, at the other beach, were regulars under the command of General Young, a former Union general. So General Young had fought for the North during the Civil War.
So there's a lot of like ex-Civil War dudes.
Yeah, especially at the high levels of command. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. They weren't generals during the Civil War. They tended to be younger officers.
Like colonels and stuff.
Yeah.
But the troops at Daiquiri were mostly volunteers. So the troops at Siboney are mostly regulars. The troops at Daiquiri are mostly volunteers. And they're under the command of Fightin' Joe Wheeler, a former Confederate general.
Every time the word "fightin'" comes in front of a general, just assume it's not fighting and war criminal. Just assume it's war criminal Joe Wheeler. Am I right about
more or
that?
Less, yeah. So I'm shooting. Yeah.
This was about the time that the North and the South were white.
North.
We love you.
Yes, the white North and the white South.
You know, yes, where. Yeah.
I don't know German.
Kissing and making up.
I don't know German that well, but I'm pretty sure translated it was the fighting Heydrich Himmler. I'm pretty sure that's how they translated
it. So on June 23rd, the day after the landings, Wheeler, wanting to beat those damn Yankees to Las Guasimas, sent Roosevelt's men ahead with great haste. Little did they know that the Spanish were entrenched on high ground. So the weather is hot and humid, the terrain is jungle with a dense underbrush, so that the men could barely see in front of them. Mm. Roosevelt would recall hearing bird calls, but he did not realize that these were Spanish lookouts signaling to their comrades the advance of the Americans. At 7 a.m., the air is rent with the crack of rifles, the buzzing of bullets, and men begin to drop. The first being Hamilton Fish II, the grandson of Secretary of State Fish, from our Gordon Gordon episode.
No.
So the ambush was made worse by the fact that all of the Spanish troops are carrying modern Mauser rifles utilizing smokeless powder. So the Mauser is a much better rifle, and you cannot use the puff of smoke to tell where the Spanish troops are. Mm. So Roosevelt kept his cool and ordered his part of the regiment to lay down covering fire while the rest, led by him carrying a wounded man's carbine, charged in. The Spanish fled from their positions and were caught in the crossfire. General Wheeler, caught up in the excitement and being approximately 100 years old, cried, "The damn Yankees are on the run," end quote. By 9 a.m.
Oh, yeah. He was on the run.
Yeah.
I forgot. I have read that someplace.
He's like, I don't know where I am. I thought I was in Atlanta.
Have you ever seen Blackadder, the Rowan Atkinson show where it takes place in... And Stephen Fry is in it, and his character is always kind of buffoonish. But the World War I version is very funny. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Fry plays a British general, and he comes down into the trenches. Are you ready to give those French a damn good licking? And his chief of staff goes, "The Germans, sir, they're supposed to be licking the Germans." He goes, "Don't be revolting. I wouldn't lick a German if he was glazed in honey."
Yeah,
no. And it's very funny.
Wait, shit. I'm so old, I forgot where I am.
So by 9 a.m., it's all over, right? The battle only lasts about an hour.
The Confederacy finally won in Cuba.
The Rough Riders had suffered the most of any of the units engaged, with 7 dead out of a total of 16 for the whole engagement.
That's not a lot.
Yeah, it's a minor skirmish, yeah. And 13 wounded out of a total of 52 wounded. So when you can divide those out amongst all the different units. The skirmish at Las Guasimas was small in scale, but it had a large impact on Roosevelt and his men. So the men of the Rough Riders, like so many men before and after, began to view Roosevelt with awe. They had seen him calmly walking along the firing line, constantly in danger, but never hurt. His tactics may have been wanting, but no one could gainsay his leadership or his courage. Roosevelt, in turn, cared for his men like they were his own sons. For instance, he essentially stole...
A little better.
Yeah, maybe a little better.
A little better than his own sons.
Maybe.
Sorry, TR.
But for instance, he essentially stole 1,100 pounds of beans, claiming with a straight face that they were for his officers rather than for his men, because men didn't rate beans.
They didn't what?
Rate beans. That like the quartermaster's like, the beans are only for the officers. And Roosevelt's like, yeah, I have 1,100 pounds of beans. My officers and I were really hungry, and then he gives them to his men, right? Like he lies to the quartermaster to get more food for his troops.
Right. Beans, though?
Yes, beans.
Were beans like a big deal back then?
Apparently.
That's all
baked,
right.
Baked beans, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Fair enough. I mean,
Rough Riders and the Roosevelt... And
well, it was better than what the regular troops had to eat, which was each other.
just hardtack and salt pork.
Oh, dear.
The Rough Riders and Roosevelt rested for 6 days and then began their march in Santiago. So what did we learn? And Kunin, you beat me to the punch on this, which is Roosevelt walked the walk. While talking the talk. He'd been in the front rank of saber-rattling with Spain, and now he was in the front rank of fighting the war. He had not only seen combat with its attending horrors, right? He knew Hamilton Fish II. Like, they were kind of friends, right? But he had also seen how complicated organizing an expeditionary war is, right? Mm. That it, it isn't. It's much simpler to say we're going to go to war with Spain. Cuba's only 90 miles away. And again, he's part of a cavalry unit where only he and his boss have a horse, mm-hmm. right? That's kind of the point of cavalry, is to have horses.
Everybody's got horses, yeah.
So that is the end of part two of Roosevelt's Crowded Hour.
I do have another lesson learned.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. right? Absolutely. Maybe this is a joke, I'm not even sure, but mm-hmm. it seemed like so many generals from that time, mm-hmm. part of being a great general was just like, walking along the line with your fingers crossed. Like, it's just like, I am going to be a great general if one of these bullets doesn't go through my fucking skull.
No, that is something that military leadership has always required, which is you cannot be a great military leader and not be personally courageous. Mm. You can't do it. You have to, like, even like people, there's the stereotype. We keep talking about World War One, which makes sense. But
aren't there a lot of like aristocrats who just kind of like inherit generalships back then?
Well, so they do. That's true. But to be a great military leader, that's what I mean. You could be a foppish aristocrat and be a general and be bad at it.
Yeah.
But to be because you're a coward. But like during World War One, there's this image we have in our head that all of the generals of World War One sat in these comfy chateaus 25 miles behind the lines, and they never got their boots dirty. And it's like, if you
not
actually
never, but most of the time.
But when you dig in, but the thing is when you dig into the number of generals who die in World War One in combat, the numbers are surprisingly high. Mm. If you assume that they all spend
3%. No.
now the most dangerous rank in any army statistically is second lieutenant. Right. That is the most dangerous rank. Like as a percentage, they die at the highest. At the highest levels,
because you have to.
You have to do what you were saying, Kunin. You have to walk up and down a fighting line, crossing your fingers, hoping that the bullet with your name on it is somehow in your pocket, right? But again, that is an aspect of if you're going to be, you can be a poor military leader and a coward. But you cannot be a great military leader and a coward. Mm. You can't. You have to have personal bravery in order to make it that far, most of the time. And to be great at it, right? Again.
I mean, what about mm-hmm. counterpoint, like Robert E. Lee or Ulysses Grant? Mm-hmm. They weren't.
Really they were right. Like there's multiple, especially Lee. Like Grant does. Especially earlier in the war, is exposing himself to fire. But during the Overland campaign, in that last campaign in 1864, there are multiple occasions that are called the Lee to the rear moments, where Lee, the first one is at the Wilderness. The Union troops have nearly broken through, and the Texas Brigade comes up, and Lee is going to lead the Texas Brigade into the line. And the Texas Brigade goes, we will charge the entire Union Army, but not before you leave. Mm. You have to go back. We will go in. We will do what you ask us to do. But we are not going to let you face bullets because we don't want you to get hurt.
Because that would have won the war.
Jackson had already died.
Yeah, the thing is that it's as uncomfortable as it is, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, Kunin, the most well-loved American soldier, like the most well-loved American general by his men, is Robert E. Lee. Yeah. No general ever in any other war ever has the same bond with his men as Lee does. Mm. And it's because his men are there the whole time, right? Most of those men serve with him for 3 or 4 years. And two, he wins a lot, right? The combination of those things will make men love you, right? Mm. There are men who love Washington and love Grant and Sherman, and there will be men who love serving under Patton. Most men who love serving under Patton will remember that they loved it like 50 years afterwards because they hated it while they were doing it because he sucked. Like as a boss, like you're person, like, you know, maybe the best example of this is if you ever watched the movie Patton, there's these two wounded soldiers walking down a road and Patton drives by them and one of them goes, there goes old blood and guts. And the other one goes, yeah. Our blood, his guts, right? You know, so it's that sort of thing. But yeah, no, you would have to be you would have to end up exposing yourself to danger at a certain point.
It just makes me think how many fucking brilliant generals just got aced in the face, like their first battle. Yep. You know what I mean?
No,
like,
I mean, it's just, not. Yeah. And it's true. Like, for instance, you know, if you go to McPherson Square in Washington, right? McPherson is killed is wounded in combat and dies like a day later. But he was like 35. And Sherman and Grant.
Where was he killed?
Outside of Atlanta during the Civil War. And both Sherman and Grant are like, that man is going places. That young man is going places. Mm. Like they were like, he is going to be.
Also, what was that Confederate general in Shiloh who gets.
Albert Sidney Johnston gets killed at Shiloh. Ironically, because the bottom of his boot gets shot off and then he gets shot in the leg. And so his artery has been cut, but the blood isn't pooling up his boots. The blood is draining out the bottom, so he doesn't realize he's been shot until it's way too late. And he dies with a tourniquet in his pocket.
It's a real mousetrap of an injury. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Well, he was leading his men from the front. This is what happens. He's leading his men from the front. A bullet whizzes by and blows off the bottom of his boot, which doesn't hurt him, and then a bullet hits him in the leg, and he's like, oh, it's not that bad, because if it was really bad, the blood would be pooling up in my boots and spilling over the top, and then I would know I was bleeding to death, and instead it just keeps draining out the bottom, so...
Science!
So, yeah.
Do you have a lesson learned? Did you do your lesson learned?
You gotta get out of Tampa Bay as soon as possible.
Get out of Tampa Bay!
To all our listeners in Tampa Bay. Yeah.
You keep pluralizing our listeners. Our listener.
We've moved on. So we have.
Oh, that's true. We have confirmed
listeners.
We have two confirmed
and, Paul. I don't know about Paul.
I don't know about Paul.
It's a comic. His dad listens to our podcast.
Well, thank you, Paul's dad.
So he was a social studies teacher.
Near and dear to my heart.
Near and dear to Dr. Harrison Stage Scholar's heart. I was told personally that he listens to our podcast.
Oh, fantastic.
So, Paul, what's up, man?
And Paul's dad? We like you even more than Paul.
Paul's the dad.
Oh, Paul's the dad.
His son is Connor. Connor McCrone. You know him.
I know.
He's a comic.
I know. Yeah. I'm sure.
Don't all comics know each other?
No. Yeah. Well, they're supposed to.
Yeah, Paul.
But, you know.
Yeah, Paul's the.
Well, yeah, thank you, Paul.
The civics teacher.
Welcome.
Keep fighting the good fight that is pointless. You know what I mean?
Frank said he listened to our podcast.
Oh, yeah, Frank.
Frank Giordano.
Fucking Italians. I'm just kidding. We love Italians here on Laughing Historically. Literally, you made up like 30% of European history, so well done. Well done on that.
Yeah, you made it. All right. Thank you so much for listening to our episode. You know, if you like our show, please like and subscribe. Follow us, Laughing HIST on Instagram.
5 stars, baby.
5 stars, share. Comment, ask questions. Dr. Hissy Scholar loves questions.
Well, and if you
and
ask him, if you ask him a question, right? Like, ask him something like weirdly specific. You know what I mean? Like, ask him like how many people at San Juan Hill had suffered a previous knee injury. And he'll be so excited to try and find it out. He might not find it out, but he'll be so excited to dig through.
At least two.
Well, right. Previous to San Juan Hill, right?
Yeah, I have to imagine at least two. Yeah, I'm just playing the odds. Yeah.
It's like, how much syphilis?
100%. It's always 100%.
Adam, stop being autobiographical.
I've never had syphilis. The reason I can say that is because the syphilis has made me go crazy. And I don't believe anything that's real. I don't have syphilis. Fuck you guys.
Please like and subscribe and comment.
Don't give syphilis.
Yeah, don't get. If you get syphilis, let us know about it.
Leave a comment.
Leave a comment if you want to know about it.
Should we do a whole episode on syphilis?
No, not
why? It'd be great. It'd be a great episode.
Who's a famous person with syphilis?
So many. There's like kings and queens and philosophers and poets.
Ben Franklin? No.
No, no. But Voltaire had syphilis?
You would think that Ben Franklin would happen.
Yeah. Man, how did he avoid that bullet is the real question.
Lucky bastard.
Heart disease. He had a heart attack before the syphilis really kicked in.
And that's our show. Thank you so much for listening.
It's our show!